The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week's programme is dedicated to looking at how scientists around the world are relying on members of the public to analyse their data.
The use of crowds of volunteers, hundreds of thousands of volunteers distributed all over the world to help us sort through what we can get has proved to be really, really essential to making the most of what we have about the universe.
The idea of citizen science is probably not so new. A lot of the early pioneers of the Enlightenment were nothing more than amateurs who wanted to mess around and do experiments. But as science became more specialised and required bigger, more expensive equipment, it got way out of the reach for even the wealthiest noblemen. But some of that is changing. And as a forward-thinking podcast, we thought it only right that Science Weekly should finally have a go at doing some science.
There's a crazy shiny thing in the middle, which is standing out very brightly, some random dots around it, and then generally a black sneeze.
Find out exactly what our reporter Claire Freeman's looking at a bit later. And could the results of a crowdsourced sleep survey help convince your boss that you really do need to start work just that little bit later than your colleagues? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. You could be a doctor of philosophy or a professorial couch potato. Either way, these days, any amateur scientist could help in making a difference to the world of science. You could count finches in your garden at dawn, or help to discover new planets, or interpret recordings of alien activity and extraterrestrial intelligence. While asking members of the public to collect quantitative data is not necessarily new, many research teams are now relying on crowdsourcing tactics to get the bulk of their click work done. Science Weekly reporter Claire Freeman set out to meet some of the professors using crowdsourcing to help their projects. She met an amateur scientist who's catalogued hundreds of thousands of galaxies in the past 5 years. And with the help of 6,000 Brits, Claire caught up with Professor Russell Foster to hear the results of his survey on sleep. First, though, she spoke to a man whose astronomy projects caught fire on the internet when he first launched them 5 years ago, quite literally. Astronomer Chris Lintott told Claire why crowdsourcing has proven so popular.
Crowdsourcing has turned out to be a really useful technique for dealing with a fundamental problem of modern science, which is that we've got too good at getting information about the universe and about the world around us. For years, for hundreds of years, it's almost that our knowledge has been limited by what we can collect, how many galaxies we can see, how many PhD students we can send into a forest to monitor bat behaviour, how many documents we can read. And it turns out in lots of fields that's not true anymore. Computers are cheap, sensing devices are cheap, so we can get megabytes and terabytes and petabytes of information, but we still only have a few scientists. And so crowdsourcing, the use of crowds of volunteers, hundreds of thousands of volunteers distributed all over the world to help us sort through what we can get has proved to be really, really essential to making the most of what we have about the universe.
So this isn't a new thing for you. You've been doing this since 2007. How has it changed from then to now?
So it's not a new thing for me. Galaxy 2 was unbelievably for me. It feels like it was about yesterday, but 5 years ago. The main difference is I think we've learned a lot about what on earth we're doing. So when we had our original problem, which was I just had too many galaxies, I tried to get a student to look at them and tell me what shape they were. Do you see spiral arms? Are they just big balls of stars that we call elliptical? And the student, whose name was Kevin Savinsky, did 50,000. And then told me where I could stick the rest of them, which was a perfectly reasonable response. And so we put up this little website, and on the first day it crashed. There were just too many people who wanted to classify galaxies, too many people who wanted to take part in our research. So we got better, so our sites don't crash anymore. But I think the other thing that's been really surprising is how far some of the volunteers are willing to take this. So we present really quite simple tasks. Just tell me if you could see spiral arms. Listen to these two whale songs and tell me if you think they're the same whale or not. But it turns out that people, once they're enthused, once you break this barrier, that says you can't do science. Once you convince them that something simple can contribute to science, then they'll go on and do lots more. So we've had people running their own research projects. We've had people independently discovering new classes of galaxies. We have people who aren't just content with finding planets via our Planet Hunters site, but will go on to model them. And before we've got involved, will tell us what shape, what size the planet is, what type of orbit it's in, and whether there could be life there. And so one of the things I'm really interested in is how we build tools to allow people to make that transition, to go from just clicking, from sort of traditional citizen science click working, to being proper full-scale scientists competing on an equal basis with me and my students and my postdocs. So I think that's the big change. We've become more ambitious.
It's interesting how many people have started to become citizen scientists. But, you know, I could be a citizen scientist. I don't necessarily have a doctorate in science. So how reliable is the data that I or other citizen scientists could provide you? How do you do those checks?
So reliability is a big deal. It's all very well having hundreds of thousands of people taking part, but that's no good if they're not doing anything useful. I live in horror that I might waste hundreds of years of human attention just by launching a site without thinking about this. So we do spend a lot of time worrying about that. But turns out you could do simple checks. We could compare to experts. We have the 50,000 galaxies that Kevin looked at, for example. We can occasionally try and trick people. We can put, let's call them synthetic rather than fake data in. So we can put planets where there aren't planets and see if people spot them. We can either, the bad way to do it is we can just weight the people who are good and pay more attention to them. That's easy enough to do. What we're actually looking at doing now is finding ways to respond to what people are doing. So if I can see that you're making mistakes, then perhaps the system can help you out. We can give you advice. We can train you in response to what you're doing. And so as part of this transition to being much more sophisticated about how you do this, you can, I think, intervene in people's classifications and help them out. You can also get them, of course, to talk to each other. And one of the really nice things that's come out of this is a sort of social space. Once people are into the projects, they want to talk about the weird thing they've just seen. And if it's only your third galaxy, you may not know that whether it's unusual or not. But there are other people in the community who do. And if we can build the right tools for you to find them, then we find citizen scientists teaching each other. The net result is almost like, if you think about normal science having a leaky pipe of a career structure. So people talk about losing people. You do GCSEs and then most people leave. And then some people do A-levels and most people leave. And then university. And at some point at the end, you get to call yourself a scientist. The citizen science equivalent of that is you turn up on a site, you click and you've done something useful. You start talking about what you've seen and that's useful because it provides information. And then maybe you start digging a bit deeper and that's useful. And then maybe you end up as an author on a paper collaborating with scientists. So you have the same sort of sequence of increasingly involved steps, but at each stage, you're actually doing something useful. I think there's something really powerful about that idea.
More from Professor Chris Lintott on the future of crowdsourcing later in the podcast. Next, I met an expert citizen scientist, Alice Shepherd, who's discovered more than 150,000 galaxies over the past 5 years. So from bedroom scientist to professional astronomer, she's now studying towards her master's in astrophysics. Over a coffee in the Guardian's canteen, Alice showed me how easy it is to classify galaxies online. So we've just clicked onto the Galaxy Zoo website, and I am about to classify my first galaxy, Alice. I am a galaxy virgin, if there is such a thing. So we're on the website, and in front of us, a picture of a galaxy, I assume. It looks like there's a crazy shiny thing in the middle, which is standing out very brightly, some random dots around it, and then generally a black sneeze. That's what I can see. As a trained eye, what can you see?
I see a galaxy that is effectively like a dinner plate that you've picked up and held at eye level. In fact, it's round, but it's turned away from us, so we can only see the edge.
Okay, and then so the questions on the right-hand side say, is the galaxy simply smooth and rounded with no sign of a disk? So there's option of smooth, features or disk, star or artifact. So I'm going to take a wild guess and say features or disk.
And you would be exactly right.
Yes. Excellent. Okay, so we click that. What happens next? Another question, does the galaxy have mostly clumpy appearance, yes or no? Don't know that one.
Personally, I'm going to say no. You get used to the clumps. You tend to find them in further away galaxies, and I could spend half an hour explaining the physics of that, but perhaps I won't.
So we're going to say no to this answer, so we just hit no. And then another question, could this be a disk-viewed edge-on? Well, you've kind of said that, yeah, we could be looking at its side.
It absolutely is a disk-viewed edge-on. It's like two fried eggs stuck together, a straight line with a nice round blob in the middle.
And then we have, does the galaxy have a bulge at its centre? If so, what shape? Rounded, boxy, no bulge. I am going to guess that you're going to say rounded.
And you would be right. You see, Yes. You're very good at this.
And then, is there anything odd? I love that question.
Oh, it's everybody's favourite question.
What could possibly be not odd about this picture? That's what I wonder. Would you say yes or no in this one?
Well, personally, I would say no, because there's nothing that I haven't seen about 100,000 times already. And that galaxy is done.
Alice, I guess the obvious question is, how did you become a citizen scientist?
It started with a little bit of disappointment with my university degree. It was absolutely fascinating, but I felt that I wasn't really making any difference. There was nothing special, nothing new going on here. It was rather going through the motions. I did environmental science. I wanted to save the world, and then I couldn't even find a related job in it. And the thing that I love is the idea that anyone can contribute. You don't need to spend years and years of your life memorising formulae and that kind of thing. Just doing is the real way to learn.
There is obviously a big community, a whole world of bedroom scientists, I like to think, of people hiding away, classifying galaxies until 4 or 5 in the morning.
Oh, yes.
What's it like to be part of a community that's connecting? Everybody's doing the same thing towards a common goal. That must be quite an exciting feeling.
It's lovely. It's like coming home, really. At school, I felt terribly isolated because I was interested in things around me and everyone just wanted to talk about clothes. And there are so many people who feel exactly the way I do now that I'm sure that half my classmates were thinking the same thing at school. It's very friendly. We've had quite a few meetups. There's quite a few people I've actually got to know this way. Many of my friends are Galaxy Zoo people. We're like a huge family.
So how do you think I did classifying my first galaxy?
I think you did really well.
So would I be welcomed into the community from my one galaxy so far?
Of course you would. Welcome to the zoo. Tea or coffee?
Thanks to citizen scientist Alice Shepherd for her welcome into the crowdsourcing community there. And of course, you can try classifying your own galaxy. Head to galaxyzoo.org or download the app on your smartphone. Regular Science Weekly listeners may have recently taken part in some cutting-edge crowdsourcing science, the UK versus Germany sleep survey. A few weeks ago, Alex spoke to Professor Russell Foster, who was seeking our listeners' help. The aim, to see how the Brit slumber time compares and contrasts with the Germans. The survey looks at our sleep chronotypes, dividing us into categories called owls, the late sleepers and nighttime people, and larks, the early risers. Professor Foster told me why crowdsourcing and online science surveys represent such a great opportunity in his field of research.
This is a survey that was set up by Till Runneberg, and it's been going for many years now in Germany, but also there's quite a bit of sign-on in other European countries. And in fact, I got an email just the other day from a Norwegian saying, oh, you know, I've just seen this survey, would you like a Norwegian participation? And we would very much like to compare the Norwegians with the Brits and the Germans in this. Sort of genius, I suppose, of this particular survey, unlike other sleep surveys, which have essentially not differentiated between work days and free days. And so what we're genuinely able to do is look at the endogenous biology, the chronotype, versus the sort of the social imposition. And once it's set up, it sort of runs itself, and then he can sort of dip in and download the data. And it's constructed in such a way that you can sort by age across the entire population that's signed on, or you can look at particular nation states or sex, you know, anything you want. So you can mine it in lots of different ways.
Where does the research go?
Well, I think that rather important area is in social policy. So if we know that there's a large social jet lag, you know, you're getting up much earlier than when the body really wants to get up, should we not think about the way we organise our day? Should we make start times at work later? And of course, this relates very much to school starting times. And some work that we've been doing with Monk's Eaton School suggests that if you have a later start time, because remember, teenagers don't like to get up early and don't like to go to bed particularly early. Part of that is social, but part of it is biology. But in that school, exam success has gone up significantly, truantism has gone down, and the overall sense of well-being in that school has gone up enormously. So I think one can use these sorts of surveys to inform the way we organise our society as well.
So if you're an owl or a lark, then you could perhaps go to your employer and say, excuse me, I am a lark, I need to be coming in early in the morning. Is that the right way around?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, in fact, we've toyed with the idea of you know, thinking about, you know, business is 24/7, and of course you have to monitor the markets over the 24-hour day. So what you could do is chronotype your workforce, identify the morning people, the people in the middle, and then the evening people, and assign them to the various markets, the Asian markets versus the European markets versus the North American ones. And that would actually be mapping one's body sleep type onto the demands of work. I think that's a great idea.
Well, my first act of citizen science was to classify a galaxy. My second contribution was to do Professor Foster's survey. And hey, it was so easy, even I could do it in my sleep. And it was fascinating for me to discover that I'm neither an owl or a lark. I am, for the first time in my life, normal. But more interestingly was how my sleep patterns compared to the thousands of other participants.
The biological bit, the chronotype, whether you're a morning person or an evening person, is identical between the Brits and the Germans. And that's something you'd probably expect for a Northern European population. Now, the Germans generally have quite a bit of social jet lag. They're having to get up earlier than their body would normally like. We show much less social jet lag, which is really interesting. And that may be related to perhaps to a more flexible work start times. I mean, in Germany, as I understand it, there are two peaks. There's starting work at 8 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning. Whereas in the British system, it's more 9 o'clock with a few 8 o'clock starts, but not quite as much.
What about when it comes to how long we sleep? Is there a difference there between UK and Germany?
There's a subtle difference, yes. It's not statistical at the moment, but it's coming out that we would sleep around about 8 minutes longer per day than our German Europeans. And so that's 40 minutes over the working week, which is actually fairly significant. What's interesting is that the German population smokes more than the Brits. And you, again, it's early days, but you might suggest that because there's a big study suggesting that you get more smoking with increased social jet lag. So that fits with other data. However, where the Brits are very different from the Germans is in alcohol consumption. Beer consumption is about the same between the Brits and the Germans, but we drink twice as much spirits and twice as much wine during the working week.
So that doesn't surprise me that we have to sleep longer in order to sleep the hangover off.
That may be part of the explanation. We are, incidentally, according to the survey, more obese than the Germans too, which is interesting. I wouldn't have predicted that.
Now, there's a novel idea. For anyone looking for a crowdsourcing idea, maybe you could suss out how hangovers compare across the world. There are, of course, many projects out there for budding scientists to get involved in. So I asked Chris Lintott which projects were proving most popular.
One of my favourites, I think, is a project called Fold It. So fold.it, which is a protein folding game. It's very famous because they're managing to work out the three-dimensional structure of proteins, and the humans that play the game are better than the computers. It's an incredibly sophisticated system. So they've made it a reasonably engaging game. You might conceivably actually do this for fun if you're the kind of person who likes puzzle games. And secondly, all the knowledge that the experts have are encoded in the rules of the game. So you can make certain moves, but the only moves that are allowed are those that are chemically meaningful. And so it's a really smart way of doing it. So I like Fold It. And then there's a new one that I'm really impressed by, which is looking at data on neurons in the optic nerve. It's called iwire.org, and you scan through, and they've got a machine learning routine that tries to trace the neurons in this three-dimensional data, and you scan through and you color bits in that you think are connected. It sounds awful, but I lost 3 hours to it the other day, and they seem to have a good sense of what they're trying to do. And of course, I haven't even mentioned the traditional crowdsourcing projects where you send people out to look at birds, classify stuff in their garden, and so on. That's a whole different way of doing things, and there are plenty of those as well.
So we've talked about some of the successful projects, but how can you determine if a crowdsourcing project has failed? I mean, I'm assuming really that might be that not enough people take and help.
Yeah, that's certainly one way you can fail. If you fail to attract an audience, if you're standing on the street waving your arms around and you don't get a crowd, then you failed pretty badly. I think the really dangerous failures are those that do attract a crowd but haven't done anything useful with it. Either because they haven't tested in advance and they don't know whether their data is going to be useful, or because they came into it with motivations other than trying to produce science. Let's just do, there have been, I don't want to name particular projects, but if you come in thinking, let's just do an interesting activity for the public and then we'll see if we can get science out of it, you'll probably fail. And that's okay if that's how you frame it. But if people come in thinking that they're giving their time to do science and you don't fulfill that contract, I think that's dangerous.
So what will the future be for crowdsourcing then? What's going to be the next phase?
I think there's one big thing that's going to drive where crowdsourcing, or my type of data analysis crowdsourcing, is going to go in the next few years. And that's a move to live projects. So at the minute, we tend to have archived data, or at the very least, data that came off the telescope last night. In the case of a project looking for exploding stars, we have data that's just come off the telescope and we want people to look at it in the next 24 hours. There are lots of cases where you'd want people to look at things within a few minutes. So we have a good example of that. We have an alien hunting project called SETI Live, which is taking data off a telescope that's in California that really is looking for aliens. And we need to very quickly decide, A, whether there's anything there, and B, whether it's interesting or not, before the telescope moves on to its next target. Because it's no good waiting 6 months and then coming back. The signal will have gone, whether it was aliens or somebody starting a diesel car or somebody with a mobile phone walking past. And so we have 3 minutes to make a decision. So I think that's really interesting, because once you start doing live, then you can imagine, if you're a participant, I can buzz your mobile phone when I need you, not when I need somebody to help, but actually I know that you're particularly good at answering the type of question I've got right now. And I think that sort of ability to talk to individual people and say, actually, I need your brains and your eyes right now, and it'll take you 5 seconds. I think that's going to be really powerful.
Professor Chris Lintott there. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. Thanks to Chris Lintott, Russell Foster and Alice Shepherd for sharing their thoughts on the brave new frontier of doing science with the public. For details of all the projects we've mentioned during this podcast, head to guardian.co.uk/science, where you can also keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly reporter and producer Claire Freeman, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.